Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Brig Kleiss, he's founder and president of Acorn Enterprises, and he is an exponent and evangelist for the theory of panspermia, which has a provocative name. And welcome, Brig.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
I want to start off first with just an initial question. How did you get interested in this topic? I mean, I think the question about the origin of life on Earth and life perhaps in the entire universe is, of course, one that is worthy of a lifetime of effort and being a vocation rather than just a hobby. But how did you come to it?
Well, I think you've already identified it. I was always interested in, I guess, evolution more than origin of life. And I always, when I was in college, for example, had misgivings about the Darwinian account of things, like eyes. And in 1981, I read a book by Hoyle and Wickramasinghe that introduced a new possibility to me that I really liked, and that was panspermia. The book, what was the title of it? Anyway, viruses from space or diseases from space, I've forgotten which, one of those. And but they suggested that in addition to the basic panspermia theory, it was possible that evolutionary advances could be generated by new genes that are installed by viruses, and those viruses could come from elsewhere. And that just seemed like a better answer, because the concept of new genetic instructions being written by mistake did not ring true to me.
Well, let's break this down, because that's where the argument's going. But let's start with the panspermia idea is that at least the constituent elements of life on Earth may have originated in space. There was just a finding this last week that they found the constituent elements for the formation of cell membranes in space.
Right. And I read about that.
Yeah.
Well, no, what you've stated, I would call pseudo-panspermia.
Okay.
Those constituent ingredients coming from space, that's not really panspermia yet. Although that theory is new and has become almost the standard theory now. But panspermia is the theory that there are whole cells in space that are capable of being transported to planets or moons and starting life there. And it's also the process by which that happens.
Okay. And you said that there are strong and hard versions of this theory. Can you tell us what that entails?
Yeah, let me expand on that a little bit. If there are cells that could spread life, there's a theory that, for example, cells from Mars seeded life on Earth, or vice versa, a sort of interplanetary panspermia, where the cells don't travel from star to star, they just don't go that far. There's another version called radio panspermia, and this was originated by Svante Arrhenius back right after the turn of the century. He had the theory that naked cells could be driven vast distances, like across galaxies, by light pressure. That theory is now in disfavor because naked cells get damaged by ultraviolet light and by cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theory that a lot of people are familiar with called directed panspermia, which is the theory that an advanced civilization somewhere else put cells on a spaceship and aimed them at Earth, and they landed here, and that's how life started here.
Mm-hmm.
That was originated by Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel in 1973.
Popularized by Kurt Vonnegut in his short story, The Great Space Jizz Shot, right?
Where, actually, I haven't read that one, but I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, they freeze-dried mountains of sperm and shoot them through black stars, black holes.
Oh, well.
Anyway, that's Kurt Vonnegut's impression of the whole thing.
But you had asked about weak and strong panspermia.
Right.
Basic panspermia, which is not necessarily weak, but to differentiate it, we'll call it that, is the theory that I've already talked about. That is, life on a planet or moon that has no life before acquires it when cells, viable cells, arrive there from space. Now, that's only about the origin of life on a planet or moon. Evolution can also be affected by this process, and in the stronger versions of panspermia, it has to be affected by this process in order to make any evolutionary progress. In other words, in the strong version of panspermia, if the only thing that ever arrived were bacteria with the genes for bacteria, that's the only kind of life there would ever be on that planet. Unless other genes for higher life forms also arrived, there would be no evolutionary progress. So that's the strong version. Mm-hmm. And when it's pushed to its logical conclusion, it must say that life can never originate and never make evolutionary progress, but only can descend. And it's still entirely scientific, but it requires an amendment to the Big Bang theory.
Okay. Well, let's get there slowly.
I'm sorry.
Let's start with, how could any living thing survive in space? We know that there are some microorganisms that we have discovered on Earth that have survived in extremely intense environments and that have self-repair capabilities to put themselves back together after exposure to radiation. But the distances of space is what leads many scientists who look into this question to think that it's unlikely that even if you did have this kind of super bug, that you might be able to get it from one place to another, given the time involved.
Right. The time involved would present two kinds of challenges. And one of them is that the longer you're in space, the greater is your exposure to cosmic rays and ultraviolet light. But comets solve that problem entirely. If a bacterium or a bacterial spore is inside a comet, only a meter or two under the surface of the ice, protected from all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that solves the first problem. The other problem is simply, can anything survive those millions of years it would probably be? And the answer seems to be yes. There was a story within the last year or so about bacteria that were revived from a salt mine that were apparently 250 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so people like John Postgate, who's a bacteriologist in England, are now saying, actually have been saying, that probably some bacterial spores are immortal. That is, if they're protected from damage, they would remain viable forever.
So they get bopped off someplace where elsewhere they're growing. They come here in an ice-sheathed asteroid. They hit our upper atmosphere, and the asteroid is vaporized. And then they, drift down onto the planet and mix it up with our cosmic soup here?
Could come that way, or could come all the way to the surface and land in the ocean. Certain size meteoroids strike the atmosphere and then are slowed by it so that they land at no greater velocity than would a stone that was dropped from an airplane or something.
Mm-hmm.
So actually there are several ways. The way you described and that way, and even a huge, a big thing, would make an explosion and kill most things, but things on the very perimeter might survive that too. So the delivery of viable cells is not considered unlikely any longer.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming the Brig Kleiss, he's the manager of www.panspermia.org and is a nationally active speaker on the topic of panspermia. So things could land here and might have given some initial impetus to the formation of life. Now, it's not necessary for the argument of panspermia that evolution, spontaneous evolution on Earth, be unlikely, but it certainly adds some weight to the theory if it was. And you seem to be arguing that the spontaneous evolution of life on Earth would have been unlikely. Is that part of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The public is given the impression that origin of life research is making progress and we're getting closer and closer to figuring out how it might happen. But I think the very opposite is the case, that origin of life research is in a protracted retreat. But the retreat aspect of it is not publicized. Every so often they make a little advance, and that gets publicized as the article by Jason Dworkin that you referred to. But in general, they have no idea even if life can start. And to just elaborate on the experiment that Dworkin and Scott Sanford and Lou Almendola and David Deamer wrote up recently in the PNAS, they found that certain chemicals in the cold and vacuum that's space-like, when bombarded by certain rays, make a foam or make a compound which, when later wetted, turns into a foam. Well, sure, life is cells, and cells have to have containers, and these are potential containers. But it would be like my saying to you, all right, we've found a process that will make a natural process that makes thin, hard plastic. Maybe oil dries on the surface of a pond, and somehow it gets hard. And so if natural thin, hard plastic is possible, now we are about to know where handheld calculators come from. It's that far-fetched.
Mm-hmm. Now, the folks who have been critical of the plausibility, the mathematical plausibility of evolution, have been around for quite a while since Darwin, and they've primarily been associated with the religious creationist camp. I had a creationist biology teacher in high school who gave me quite a good taste of that. And you're not coming out of that terrain, are you?
No, but here's the problem I'm having, is that both camps, the Darwinists and the creationists, both actively say, listen, it's either us or it's them. There are only two possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
The Darwinists and the creationists say it. And it's not so. This is a sure enough third possibility that's mm-hmm. as different from them as they are from each other. It's fully, fully scientific, but it does accept a lot of the criticisms of Darwinism that are posed by the creationists.
And there are a growing variety of post-Darwinist evolutionary theorists out there, folks who are proposing various models of cell bootstrapping and even origin of life alternatives, right?
Sure, there's any number of theories, as you would expect, when no successful one has emerged. Chaos theory is brought into it, quantum theory is brought into it, but what is lacking is any hard demonstration in a laboratory that has any bearing on the question whatsoever, well, or has any meaningful bearing that really advances the question.
You can zap soup and it will make complex amino acids or whatever, but you can't zap soup to the point where it makes a microorganism. Is that
That's exactly right.
That's the kind of experiment you're looking for.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Exactly right.
And so it's possible, and I think it's increasingly accepted that the possibility that microorganisms could have bopped off of, say, Mars and survived a relatively short, brief interplanetary trip to Earth and dropped down here and gotten things going here. But you address this second, and that's not just the part of your argument. You think it could have survived not just from Mars, right? From interstellar space.
Right.
Okay. So that's a much more controversial claim and something which, of course, is difficult to adjudicate. But let's address the even more controversial point that you make, which is that you think that there is insufficient evidence for the evolution of life to have been simply a matter of spontaneous mutation and natural selection to create the full complexity of ecosystem as we see it. You think that there may be genetic material dropping onto Earth and being incorporated into the genome somehow. What's the mechanism and why do you want to go there?
Well, all right, what's the mechanism first? A very, very easily understandable mechanism would be viruses. Viruses install their genes and the genes they contain that may not even be their own genes originally into their hosts all the time. And the human genome is known to be at least 1% endogenous retroviruses, and probably a lot more, but older genes lose the sequences that help you recognize them as having ever been viruses. Mm-hmm. So viruses can easily install whole genes and drive evolution. That's the process, or a process.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're using now for genetic therapy, in fact.
Right. It's one thing. It's not the only thing, but it's a very promising one. Genes can be transferred without viruses, too.
Just naked DNA inserted.
Right. Plasmids are transferred that way often among bacteria, mm-hmm. for example. In fact, among bacteria now, the transfer of genes is considered to be the primary way bacteria evolve. And there was an article recently in May, I think, about E. coli in your gut and the salmonella that they're closely related to. And these scientists could find no evidence of any gene that related them by point mutations. And all the differences seem to be related to horizontal gene transfer. So that's the process. Now, you also asked about what's the justification for the challenge to Darwinism, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
Is it simply a mathematical thing that you're, again, just as the mathematical implausibility of spontaneous microorganisms being formed, you're arguing that it's mathematically implausible that we would have the complexity of life that we see it?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that it's a mathematical thing. I do think that the origin of life and the subsequent evolutionary progress are both instances of of advances in progress that they're the same kind of question. Actually, you see a lot of Darwinists who will shrug off the origin of life and say evolution and origin of life are separate questions, and I don't have to deal with that question because that's not my specialty. I think they are the same problem. And yes, mathematically, the probabilities don't work. But mathematics aside, there are no examples of it in analogous media, such as computers. There are computer people who are trying like crazy to make their programs make evolutionary progress, and they even sort of issue press releases as if they do, but they don't. And
now, one of the things that strikes me about the argument of extraterrestrial origins for genetic advance on Earth is that you would have to make a pretty strong directed panspermia argument, it seems to me, to make that argument in the notion that presumably the universe is a pretty big place and that there would be all kinds of microorganisms landing here from all kinds of places if that was what was happening. And the majority of them would be pathogenic to the life that's already here. So why would there be such a, and in fact, I guess Hoyle and Wickramasinghe believed that there might be an extraterrestrial origin explanation for some of the major pandemics that had struck Earth, right? So that's that's not a foreign argument to their thinking.
No, but now let me take issue with one minor thing. I don't see any reason to think that the majority of them would be pathogenic to people.
Well, some of them might just be oblique to our bodies, you know, that they might not attack or do anything with us or interact with us in any way. But
right.
So, but
even the ones that do, for example, most viruses infect us without any symptoms at all. That's not widely known, but it's medically known.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, there's this increasing research going on the viruses which have worked their ways, introns are they called, the viruses that have worked their ways into our genetic code and are just a part of our genetic makeup at this point.
Right. No, introns are the little interruptions in individual genes, mm-hmm. and there probably is a relationship between installation of genes by a virus and the existence of introns, but it would be a complex one that we don't understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, that process is very well accepted and well understood, and not even controversial. Back in 1987, a popular textbook about genes by James Watson and a group, he wrote that it would be a simple matter to take the entire human genome and place it onto 250,000 plasmids, which are tiny little things. They're like, they're like little bitty chromosomes. And so it would be quite simple to have 250,000 plasmids contained in bacteria that are very widespread through space and capable of arriving here.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds fantastic. People are just groaning and moaning. But
basis for a great science fiction novel, I'm sure.
But let me tell you what sounds fantastic to me. The idea that bacteria would ever, by any series of mistakes, develop oxygen metabolism, guts, nerve systems, wings, lungs, hair, feathers, speech, that any of the genetic instructions for any of those evolutionary advances would ever be written by a series of mistakes.
Aren't you just writing the problem large? I mean, since it is fundamentally a mathematical conundrum, mm-hmm. are you saying simply that because it didn't have to just develop here, that still the Darwinian process could be at work, but since it's happening on a universe-wide scale, then you have a mathematical plausibility for the argument? Or are you, in fact, hinting at a directed, a more complicated argument? I mean,
I would say neither one.
Okay.
But now, if there are, let's say, 10 to the 10th stars in our galaxy, and let's say there are 10 to the 10th galaxies, there might be 10 to the 20th more opportunities for life to originate and evolve.
Mm-hmm.
But believe it or not, that's not enough. The chances against a gene being written are much, much greater than that.
Hmm.
And so that helps, but not enough.
Okay.
And where I'm ultimately driven is to say life can never originate and can never make evolutionary progress. It can only descend. This is very hard to accept and grasp, and people continue to say, well, you're just not answering the question.
Right.
But I'm asking different questions.
Uh-huh.
You know, people used to wonder, what's at the edge of the Earth? And it turns out it's the wrong question.
Right.
And I think the question, how does life originate by natural means, is the wrong question.
Well, in your website, www.panspermia.org, you do mention the multiple universes theories that are developing and the notion that, we may be able to just keep bumping this question up to higher and higher planes.
Right.
But before we get there, you have introduced another popular scientific concept, another controversial scientific concept, into this mix, and that is James Lovelock's Gaia theory. How does that relate to the ideas that you're talking about here?
Hey, you've read so much of my website, and I really appreciate it. Actually, I think trying to marry Gaia, which is Lovelock's theory, with panspermia is kind of one of my own contributions that I'm a little bit proud of. I hope it sticks. But one of the criticisms of panspermia is, well, if that's the way it works, then why did it take so long? We know that we now believe that life was here just right away, like at 3.9 or 4 billion years ago, just as soon as the planet was cool enough. But why was it only bacteria for so long, like 2 billion years? If evolution works the way panspermia is saying, it ought to just move right along smartly. And my answer is this, that for oxygen metabolism to evolve, there first has to be an oxygen atmosphere, and that process on Earth took 200 or 300 or 400 million years. So not only does life have to evolve, but the planet has to be engineered for life, and the planetary engineering takes a long time. But that's the process that Lovelock has taught us a lot about with his Gaia theory.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So say some more about that. How does that work?
Well, the easiest way for me to talk about it is just imagine that we knew that our planet was going to be engulfed by the sun because it was going to explode and become a red giant, and we had time to plan, and we wanted to continue to survive somehow. One thing that we might do is send our bacteria out in some form, not necessarily in spaceships, but maybe figure out how to get them onto comets. Then we would be thinking, all right, now how are we going to have any descendants at any point ever emerge as an intelligent species that could ever sort of figure out where they came from? Well, what's going to have to happen? Let's say they go to a barren planet. First of all, they've got to engineer the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So let's make sure that the bacteria that could do that are available. And then let's acknowledge it would take a very long time to build up an oxygen atmosphere on a planet that had none. And so if it makes sense to me that a process like that, even if not so consciously thought about the way I just have, could be the way that life begins on planets.
Well, what's the progress that your idea is having out there? I mean, it's not just your ideas, but you're a popularizer of a set of ideas that are being discussed in scientific circles. Are the forces you summarize in your website that NASA has begun to come around to extraterrestrial life? The announcement of the Mars meteorite that was discovered up in the Arctic. Antarctic, yeah. And so there's increasing debates about extraterrestrial life. Do you think that this theory is gaining ground?
Absolutely, it is. 25 years ago, there were several objections to panspermia. For example, microbes would be killed by radiation in space. We've talked about that one. Cells can't live long enough to take those trips. The heat of the atmospheric entry would sterilize them, or there's not enough evidence of organic compounds in space, and there's not any water out there. Well, all of that is now, all those objections have been reversed. And the idea that prebiotic molecules might come from space is almost the accepted theory now. So there's a ton of momentum in favor of the theory. But in my opinion, it's still going, and the implications of the theory will continue to unfold. Not like we've suddenly... Science always acts like now finally we know almost everything, and we never do. We keep learning more, and I think we will learn more about this, and the paradigm will continue to shift.
I see that you recently delivered a paper at the Optical SETI Conference in San Jose.
Right.
Do you think that your theory has ramifications for the SETI project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life? Or do you expect... recently I interviewed some fellows, I forget their names right now, but they they wrote a book about the implausibility that intelligent life would be discovered in our galaxy, and argued that probably the only kind of life, and I guess Carl Sagan believed this as well, probably the only kind of life we'd be likely to run across would be microorganismic. Do you think that the set of ideas that you're pulling together here suggest more intelligent life in the universe or more non-intelligent life?
Well, that's kind of a hard one. You know, if Earth was seeded by germs, probably so were all the other planets around us, and nothing has persisted on them. So it may well be that there are lots of germs waiting to seed life, but even after the seeding, there are a number of things that could cause the project to fail.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually don't know what the implications are for intelligent life except with this proviso. Under the strongest version of panspermia, life can only descend. And that would mean that we have to have, even though they might be extinct now, we have to have had at some point intelligent ancestors somewhere in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. The catastrophism ideas in astrophysics seem to be growing apace along with this interest in extraterrestrial life. I think in particular of gamma ray bursts, things that can go wrong with solar systems, novas, and so forth. The research that's being done on planetary formation and how you need a very precise set of conditions to have a planet that might be compatible with life. And it seems like given when you add up, and this is what these folks who wrote this this book about the implausibility of intelligent life, when you add up all those conditions to get to the mathematical possibility of a civilization like ours, you almost need a deus ex machina, some kind of intelligent intervener.
Well, I don't agree with that very last suggestion, but I think they may well be right that it is difficult.
I put the emphasis on machina and not the deus.
All right. Yeah, I guess you mean Ward and Brownlee. The book was
right.
Earth.
Ward and Brownlee. That's it. They're the ones.
Yeah. I'm hoping to read that soon, but they may well be right. I'll tell you who was at this conference was Francis Drake of the Drake Equation.
Uh-huh.
And he lists in his Drake Equation a number of things that have to go right for intelligent life to emerge. And, you know, we don't know. We haven't seen any signal from intelligent life yet elsewhere. And so it's very difficult for us to know how abundant it may be. And that's sort of a question I enjoy hearing about, but don't have much
to say about yet.
Right.
Well, good. Given all the things that you've bitten off to chew, it's good that you know your limits as well. I've been speaking with Brig Kleiss. He's the founder and president of Acorn Enterprises, and he manages the www.panspermia.org website, which has a number of very interesting documents, provocative documents about the panspermia thesis. Thank you very much for joining us, Brig. And is there anything coming out soon that people should watch out for?
Jay, I wish there were, and there's some interesting developments with respect to life on Mars. There's a Lunar and Planetary Science Conference coming up in Houston in March, and there will be several papers there saying that we should reconsider the Viking evidence for life. Remember the Viking experiments that landed on Mars in 1976? They actually had life detection experiments, and one of them got a positive result 18 out of 18 times in two different locations. And they are now saying those experiments need to be reconsidered. So that's an exciting development. But paradigms are so hard to shift that I almost think that if we had a sample and brought it back from Mars and it had living germs on it,
you'd still have a hard time.
You'd still have a hard time. Back when in 1996, when they first had the meteorite from Mars, I think Stephen Jay Gould wrote in the New York Times, "Well, big deal. It's just not a big deal." And I think the progress will be slow.
I expect you'll keep up the good fight.
Well, I hope to. I want to thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.